From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us now at 800-462-7413. Zorba, tell us about the topics we have this hour.
Yes, we're going to talk about depression in moms and dads and how it may affect the baby's birth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also going to talk a bit about Zika, the virus that is frighteningly around the world, and sort of a little bit about it and what we might ultimately be able to do about it.
I have a personal interest in that topic. I'll be listening. What's our recipe?
Red lentil hummus, if you like hummus. This is really easy. It's a simple recipe. Sometimes I like complex, and a lot of times I like simple. You will love this if you like hummus.
Simple is good. 800-462-7413 is our number. To the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in McHenry, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Zorba. I'm a longtime listener and have listened to your advice a lot. And I have a question about jogging for older middle-aged people.
How old are you?
Well, I said older middle age. I'm 57.
57. Okay. Now, Tom, would you call 57 old?
Oh, no, that's definitely middle age.
Neither would I. I would call that solidly middle age. So you have to get rid of old. You have to call yourself middle age. So go on.
Well, I've heard recently that jogging for people over 40 isn't good because it's too hard on joints and causes premature aging.
Causes premature aging. So that's kind of interesting. Well, it is harder on joints. Our joints are better when we're younger. That's for sure. So you like to jog, I take it, right?
I do. I just jog a couple times a week and just go about 3 miles or so.
3 miles or so. What do you jog on? Jog on cement? Do you cross country? Where do you go?
Roads mostly, so blacktop.
Yeah. How are your joints?
My joints are fine. I've never had knee pain or anything, and I using good shoes, I'll qualify that.
You just hit the most important thing of all. It's using good shoes, using common sense. If you get into a new pair of shoes, especially jogging shoes, the first thing I notice is, wow, when I put on my new shoes and my old shoes, I rarely go back to my old shoes. In other words, if I put on new shoes and then I try my old shoes, I go, my goodness, they really don't have the bounce that I have. So that's kind of part of it, because part of it is protecting the arch and making sure you have enough bounce when you are actually bouncing on the shoes. Second of all, it's where you jog. You know, if you're jogging, on hard cement, on ice where you're likely to slip, that's more likely to really cause a problem. But I don't think there's any evidence it causes premature aging. I just think that it's a function of the person. So I got to ask you another question. Mom and dad, are they still around or have they passed?
They're not.
Did they have arthritis?
No, not significantly.
Not significantly. It's a big issue. You know, if you have a family history of arthritis, mom and dad, let's say they had a knee replacement, hip replacement, any kind of a joint replacement when they were in their 50s, you know, or something of that, it may lead to the fact that you might have a strong family history. It sounds like you don't have a family history. Do you smoke?
No, I don't.
You don't smoke. Smoking leads to premature arthritis. It's one of the other risk factors associated with that. Are you overweight?
No.
You're not overweight. So you jog, so you've got good muscle tone. I'm going to assume that. You're not overweight. You don't smoke. You're going to have some good shoes because you're going to go out and look at some good shoes on the net. I think you can keep on jogging. That's what I would do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Now, I do the treadmill. Not so much anymore. Now I'm walking a lot. Yeah. Do I use the same shoes for jogging, walking, treadmill?
Well, first of all, the shoe lobby would like you to make you think that you have different shoes for other things. Let's talk about that. I'm not a member of the shoe lobby. And let's also not forget that about 3 decades ago, I was one of the world's foremost authorities on skipping. I managed to get a graduate student, a guy named Greg. I do not remember Greg's last name. Wonderful guy. And Greg, if you're listening, please call call up. I know you lived in Appleton, Wisconsin, or somewhere last time.
I remember when you were a skipper.
We did research on skipping. We showed that skipping was more aerobic than jogging, and we were ready to go in and market skipping shoes. We found out that bowling shoes were great for skipping because of the slide. You know, it's a hop, a jump,
well, you
and a
gave
slide.
It up because you couldn't take other people laughing
oh,
at
God,
you.
Oh, God, it was so funny.
When they saw
who
you
would
skipping?
Skip? You know, other than when you're, you know, other when you're a young kid, that's about, you know what? You know what? In the springtime, I'm going to put a YouTube out on skipping. There is no doubt about it. Not in the wintertime, because I will kill myself on the ice, but in the springtime. But getting back to the issue at hand,
yeah.
You've got to have some shoe with a bounce in it. I don't think you need a special shoe for walking,
okay.
But you've got to have a good arch. And the problem with shoes are sometimes shoes are comfortable and they become more like house slippers and they don't give us the support that we need. And there's a lot of plantar fasciitis. There are a lot of bunions. There are a lot of problems that we have in our feet as we get older because our joints in our feet are not that good. And we don't go out and spend the money on a good new shoe that has bounce to it.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. So, Zorba, depression in mom or dad can increase the risk of a premature baby.
Oh, yeah. And before we talk about this study, I want to tell you something else that I think is important. Screening for postpartum depression, which is really part of normal screening during pregnancy, is critically important because we know postpartum depression is very common after women have a baby, and it's a biological issue. But one of the issues is whether or not you should screen before a woman gets pregnant. Let's say you have a couple, they're thinking about having a baby. Should you actually say, hey, I want to be screened for depression and maybe I should have some counseling or maybe I should be on an antidepressant or both? And this particular study...
You think, though, soon-to-be parents would be ecstatic rather than
depressed. Yeah, but depression is common. Depression is a common issue. Depression is a biological issue for some people. There's biochemical depression. So you would think that, but the answer is it's not true all the time. And this particular study is talking about just that problem. So they looked, this is a study out of Sweden. They looked at about 350,000 births, you know, births of babies. They looked at it. And they looked at the new diagnosis of depression, not recurrent depression. New diagnosis of depression. And they found out that if the mom or the dad... The mom or the dad, get this, had a new diagnosis of depression, that it significantly increased the risk of a premature baby.
Yeah.
In other words, we're not talking about postpartum depression now. We're talking about depression in mom or depression in dad. A new depression that was diagnosed during pregnancy, it increased the risk 34% if a mother became depressed or a father became depressed during pregnancy, that a baby was more likely to be born between 32 and 36 weeks.
Why would the dad's depression?
Well, first of all, we're not thinking right about pregnancy. The fact is the dad is important during pregnancy too. It's not a biological issue. It's a family issue. Think about it. You're home, you're a woman, what's the psychosocial situation if you are a woman dealing with a husband who may be depressed or not even a husband, the other person living with you. Remember, this is Sweden where having children together is very common and not getting married is also much more common in Sweden than it is here where a couple stays together their whole life and often never gets married. What happens if the father gets depressed?
So we're talking about the father's depression.
And the mother's depression.
Playing on the mom.
Yeah.
And that's why the baby would be.
Well, that's exactly what it is. So let's look at it globally. It's a new diagnosis. So if mom has a new diagnosis of depression, or if dad has a new diagnosis of depression, it increases the risk of prematurity. What does that mean? So we look stand up. It means that we're not screening appropriately for depression of the mom and the dad. And if we look back to other issues, it may be that when a mom and dad are thinking about getting pregnant, they both should be screened for depression. And it may mean that they get counseling beforehand and do things on a natural way. I'm not talking about even a drug way of dealing with it prior to having a child, but certainly during the time of the pregnancy.
So,
no one ever thinks about the dad.
So you wouldn't
they think
wait
about the
for,
mom.
You wouldn't wait for a depression to happen. You would get screened ahead of time?
Well, that's a good question. That's what this brings up. It brings up the fact that depression is more of a ubiquitous risk factor than we have thought of before in prematurity. When you have a premature child, you have a bunch of risks that you want to try to decrease. And so, you know, we talk about smoking. We know smoking increases prematurity.
Oh, sure.
We know history of prematurity. We know alcoholism increases. Mm-hmm. So we look at all this screening, but we never look at the dad. We don't bother thinking about
right,
the dad.
Right.
Has the dad been looked at for depression? And maybe the dad needs to be on an antidepressant because dads support moms if they live together. And maybe, and obviously, that psychosocial situation mm-hmm. affects the baby and may affect the baby long-term 20 years down the line because of prematurity.
That's really interesting.
This is a very important study.
Yeah.
This is a monumental study looking at the whole universe of what surrounds a child with birth. And I think this is going to change the way we look at pregnancy. We're going to spend more time also looking at the dad, which we don't do.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. Back to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Greenbush, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
So I have a bit of a health question. Throughout the majority of my life, probably ever since I was 7 or 8, I've had these visual disturbances that for the longest time I couldn't contribute to anything. What would happen is I'd be reading something or watching TV or looking out the window, and all of a sudden I wouldn't be able to focus on what was right in the center of my vision, and it would be a little fuzzy, flickering spot. And then probably over the next 20 minutes or so, that little spot would blow up into like a crescent moon shape that would usually sit in my peripheral vision somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a shimmery, multicolored, zigzaggy line that mm-hmm. would move and change around. So it would only last about 20 minutes. And then, probably for the first 10 years I had them, I'd get a little bit of a headache afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'll just get the visual disturbance and then it goes away. So for a long time, I had no idea what they were or what caused them.
Sure.
And then it wasn't until I was in college that I really correlated it to drinking coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't drink a lot of pop, so I didn't know if it was the caffeine or if it was something in coffee. But really, I was just kind of wondering what they are, if it's part of any other underlying condition I need to be aware of or what.
Yeah, I think it's a migraine. I think you're having a visual migraine.
Okay.
I mean, you're describing perfectly what a visual migraine is like. And as you said, sometimes you would get a headache afterwards, and it's a scotoma, we call it. I mean, you know, these wavy kind of lines. And I don't think it's a seizure. I mean, you have no seizure-like activity. It could be a seizure, but I rather doubt it. It fits with a visual migraine headache. And visual migraines, among other things, have certain triggers. And caffeine can certainly be a trigger of visual migraine. Lack of sleep is often a trigger of migraine headaches. If you read about migraine headaches, certain foods can do it. For some people, certain wine, alcohol can do it. And for other people, they just happen randomly. And migraines tend to get better over time. I got my first migraines when I was 5, terrible migraine headaches, and I've never had visual disturbances in mine. It pretty much disappeared. They don't bother me very much anymore at all. And it sounds like yours have gone in evolution. How old were you when you first noticed this?
Oh, I can't remember specifically.
Well,
but
think back. How young? 5, 10?
Between five and ten.
Yeah, what'd you think of it when it first happened? What was your first thought?
I had no idea what to think. I was pretty scared at first, and then
that's scary. Did you tell your mom?
I think so. I would assume so.
Uh huh. Ask your mom. Ask her.
Okay.
Call her
I'm
up
sure
and
she'd
ask
remember.
Her. Yeah, I bet you would remember because you would have described it to your mom. Have you talked about this to many other people, like your doctor or anything else?
No, not really.
How come?
I did some digging on the internet,
and
it never seemed anything that was too serious. So I guess I was just kind of let it go.
But yeah, I think these are visual scotomas, and basically.
Okay.
They're not bothering you. You don't have to take anything for it. It goes away over time. You're aware of it. Sometimes a dark room, if you're having a headache. But that's what this is. And they change over time. They may continue for the rest of your life or not. But talk to your mom and ask her if you ever talked about it, because you might find it very interesting.
Okay, thank you. I have one other question.
Sure.
Do you think now I don't really get much of a headache with them, but
mm-hmm.
do you think they'll ever develop into getting more of a full-blown migraine?
Well, first of all, number one is you haven't had it, so I doubt if you're going to have it. I think the chances are less. But with migraine headaches, the first thing I recommend is you use over-the-counter medication and Excedrin migraine. I happen to like it. It's my go-to medication because it's acetaminophen and aspirin, and it works well for a lot of people. And so if you get it, pop two of those and see if they work. And if not, my second drug is Aleve. Double the dose in the bottle, two tablets twice a day if they bother you. That's what I would do. So if you get a full-grain, you know, full-blown migraine, but if you haven't gotten one, you're probably never going to get one, you know, and if it is, it may just be like a regular headache, but that's what I would do.
Good.
Good luck. Call your mom. Always good to call your mom anyway.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Now, he could put down the pop. He's in Wisconsin. He could put down the pop and go to the bubbler.
Oh, go to the bubbler. That's right. The bubbler, the other thing. Yeah, but the bubblers were the water. Remember when you were a kid, the water fountains would run continuously. I remember. In Chicago, they would run continuously.
Those people don't know what a bubbler is.
No, they do not know what a bubbler is. They don't know what they're missing, bubblers and pop.
Before we take a break, Zorba, let's tackle an email question from Mitch in Madison, Wisconsin. Dear Dr. Zorba and non-Dr. Tom, I've enjoyed your show for many years, and it is the highlight of my day. My question is regarding the risk of brain damage due to alcohol consumption. In general, I am a weekend warrior when it comes to booze, Friday, Saturday, and sometimes Sunday nights. I will have about 6 or 8 beers over the course of the evening, but I don't drink at all during the week, and I believe my diet is otherwise a tad better than your average middle-aged man in Wisconsin. I've read reports that talk about cognitive decline of people who, quoting, drink too much for too long. However, they never specify what is too much or how long is too long. Are they referring to several-year binge drinkers like myself, or are they talking about the guy who drinks a gallon of gin a day every 30 days for years?
A gallon of gin? I mean, I have had patients who have drank a quart of alcohol, but I have never had patients who have drank 4 quarts of alcohol in a day.
Yeah, you know what he's talking about, though. I know that you're the kind of loving doctor, and you will tell me to knock off the binge drinking regardless, and I appreciate that. But am I in the process of drinking myself stupid?
Well, first of all, the answer is yes, you can drink yourself stupid. Is there a number? We have no double-blind placebo-controlled trials where we put half the people on binge drinking, half the people off binge drinking, and follow them. We just know that when you average more than 2 drinks a day for a man, more than 1 drink away, you know, a day for a woman, 1.5 is sort of where the number is, over a period of time, that it increases the risk factor for high blood pressure, stroke, heart attacks, and so on. Is there a magic number? Not at all. Now, what do we know about binge drinking? We know binge drinking isn't good for you. Now, does it lead to more cognitive decline? I don't think that we have an exact number on this. And so the problem is, as we get older, we're much more likely to have cognitive decline because age is the biggest risk factor for cognitive decline. We know that excess alcohol is more likely to lead to strokes and TIAs and other things that can permanently damage the brain. That's where it fits. Now, can I say that you should stop binge drinking? Yeah, of course. I mean, what am I going to say as a doctor, right? Oh, it's okay to binge drink. Now, am I talking about, you know, when the Packers, you know, beat the Vikings on a day like that, if you want to have a bunch of beers, you know, people do that. But if you're doing it every Friday or Saturday night, no, it's not a good idea. And you may be drinking yourself stupid. So the question you have to answer is, how much do you value your intelligence? That's the bottom line.
Have a question for Zorba? He's happy to dole out the advice straight up, no chaser. Just post it to our Facebook page.
Top rail.
Or send it along in an email to
Top Shelf, Zorba at WPR.org. Or find us on Facebook. And you can tell how much I drink when I was saying top rail versus top shelf.
Our recipe is coming up. You'll want to hear about that. More of your calls, of course. A medical mythbuster, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is our number. We have a line open for you if you'd like to call us now. But Zorba, before our next call, red lentil hummus.
That's right. Red lentil hummus. Now, do you like hummus?
No.
That answers that question.
Moving right along.
You know, that was a definitive no. There wasn't even like a break. Like, right. I have to think about it.
Right.
It was like, no, it's not something that, like. How about Monica? How about your wife? Does
I
she
like her
hummus?
Fine. Yeah. I like her a lot.
That's very good. You are sharp. You know something? You'll get points when you go home. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. You know, you can use the points when you're in the doghouse.
Absolutely.
You can say, hey, honey, yeah. On the air, you know, as long as I do, you're like, okay. Well, for those people who like hummus,
Let's do it.
A very simple
yeah.
recipe. So you start out with a cup of red lentils.
A couple of red lentils.
Do you like lentils? Okay, we're going to use some water here. A couple of garlic cloves peeled.
Two garlic cloves peeled.
That's right. You're going to have the zest from half a lemon, and then you're going to use the peel from half a lemon, okay?
Okay, the zest from half a lemon and the peel from half a lemon.
That's right. Now, when you zest your lemons, what do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah, that's right. We'll just leave it just like that.
I enjoy the zest.
That's right. Enjoy the zest.
Yeah.
Zest in your life.
Yeah.
That's right. Zest
right.
in your life. That's about as good as it. A couple of tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
Two big tea, extra virgin
yeah,
olive oil.
You little, and you're going to need a little bit of extra around this side because you're going to need some tahini paste. So you're going to have to go to the bottom of your pantry and find tahini paste if it's actually
what
there.
What paste?
Tahini paste.
Tahini.
It's made from sesame seeds.
Whatever that is.
Do you like sesame seeds? You know, it's very clear this is not your recipe. But there's no, you know, we don't have any tofu in this recipe. So, I mean, you know, that would top
well,
it
there's
off.
Lemon stuff in here. I like lemon.
So you need some juice from some of the lemons.
Yeah, juice from some of the lemon.
Salt. How about, do you like salt?
Well, I don't overeat it,
yeah.
I don't think.
And if you have sumac, we're getting a couple
Let's just keep it's getting better and better.
Now there's poison sumac. We're not going to use poison sumac.
Okay.
Then you'll,
let's get
then
this
you'll
over
get
with and get back to the food.
Let's get this recipe over with. It's hard to get it over with. This is a healthy recipe, Tom.
I know.
It may not be steak and eggs, but it's a healthy recipe. Okay. I'll just try to catch my breath. Take a deep breath. Okay, in a medium saucepan over medium heat, you combine 1 cup of red lentils and 1 cup of water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cup of red lentils, 1 cup of water, garlic cloves, and the peel from half that lemon. Bring it to a simmer, cover the pot, cook it for about 20 minutes until the water's evaporated and the lentils are completely cooked. So remember, that's how you make lentils. I know, Tom, in your life, you have never made lentils. So
you got
this
that
is an educational
right. yeah.
experience.
Yeah.
And if there's a small amount of residual water left, that's okay. So remove the lemon peel that you put in there, Tom, and discard it. This would be a good way for you to sort of learn about cooking lentils if that were in your fortune, but I can tell looking at you that it's not in
whatever
your
you're saying. I haven't been paying any attention.
The magic eight ball is not saying cook lentils, and that's not in. The fortune cookie isn't saying that either. So get thee to a blender or food processor, mm-hmm. not a nunnery, but a blender or food processor. Add olive oil, lentils, the softened garlic cloves, tahini paste, if you have it in the bottom of your pantry, about a tablespoon and a half of tahini paste, and once again, that's from sesame,
mm-hmm.
juice from a lemon, few pinches of salt, pulse it until it's smooth to give it a little bit of taste, adjust the salt, transfer to a serving bowl, put a teaspoon or so of olive oil over the top, and if you have sumac, now that's not poison sumac, mm-hmm. but sumac is a taste. You can put a little sumac on top. And then serve it with some fresh vegetables or pita. Do you like pita bread?
Yeah, it's all right.
It's all right. That's about all. Or you can do what Tom does and forget the recipe and go out for a
burger.
I'm
not even going to ask for the email address.
Well, for people who actually want to have the email address, it's zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org. Come on to there. You can find other fine recipes. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, and if you want to, I do from time to time tweet.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba, as does this listener, Zorba, in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
In the early 1960s, I accompanied my parents and I went down to Florida. The place that we were staying at also had a number of people from Wisconsin there. And that was my first introduction to raw beef sandwiches or cannibal sandwiches.
What kind of sandwiches?
Raw beef, cannibal.
Raw beef, okay, raw beef, cannibal
and,
sandwiches.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I thought, what sort of demented soul would even think about eating something like that?
Germans.
And anyway, fast forward to the early 70s, I landed in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and was dating this girl who was an RN at the emergency room at Columbia Hospital. Mm-hmm. And she took me to their Christmas party held at the Milwaukee Athletic Club, which is a pretty nice place. Anyway, here they had raw beef sandwiches. And she tried to get me to eat one, and I wouldn't do it. I thought that there must be something wrong with it. But mm-hmm. then all the other medical people that were there were eating them. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know, these people are very, very smart individuals. Mm-hmm. And if they're eating them, it can't be unhealthful to you.
Of course.
So
yeah.
Anyway, uh-huh. I had one, and I fell in love with them. Uh-huh. They're great. But in the last 10 or 12 years, the dietitians now are coming down saying that you've got to have meat cooked, usually well done. And I'm just wondering, are there any pitfalls from a health standard by eating raw beef like that?
Well, Zorba, didn't you eat raw beef sandwiches?
Oh, yeah. I have been known to eat that. I've never, you mean cannibal sandwiches? Yeah. Yeah, I've been known to do that. No, so first of all, let's look at your first assumption that the doctors are intelligent. Now, let's remember that 9 out of 10 surgeons used to smoke Camels. So let's remember that. And I've got an advertisement that showed a surgeon, his mask is down, he's got his white surgical garb on, it looks like he's just finished a tough case, and it says 9 out of 10 surgeons smoke Camels. And they used to give them away at AMA conferences. They give the surgeons cartons of Camels.
None of you doctors smoke Camels now.
That's right. Right. Actually, believe it or not, well, I'm sure you can't. 5 or 10% of the doctors, depending on where you in the country are in the country, smoke. Mm. They still smoke. So being a physician doesn't mean you're smart. It just means you're a physician. That's about as far as it goes. You know, you might be able to do a heart transplant, but it don't mean you're smart somewhere else. Now, cannibal sandwiches. You know, it's interesting. I've got two wonderful nurses that are in their 90s. Very good friends. And we were talking about a month ago in my office, and they said they love cannibal sandwiches. They occasionally eat raw beef sandwiches. And I said, well, it's a little risky. You're in your 90s. And the risk is E. coli. That's what it is. You know, it's uncooked meat with E. coli. So is it a problem? Yeah. Is it healthy? No. There are a number of things that we eat that are not healthy. You know, eat sushi. It's not cooked, and there's a risk of getting something from sushi also. So how do you reduce the risk? Well, first of all, if you're going to make the sandwich, you can easily reduce the risk by buying a good piece of meat. Sirloin, for instance, taking it and washing the outside of the sirloin, because E. coli is not inside that steak. It's on the outside. Washing it, putting it in a food processor, and then you process it or you put it in a meat grinder, and you can have, you know, a raw meat sandwich, and your risk of E. coli is pretty nil because you've washed the outside mm-hmm. of the meat. Mm-hmm. When you buy raw meat in the grocery store, it comes from a variety of different places. It's not usually from one animal. It's other animals. And the risk, because E. coli can be on the outside, the risk is increased because you have beef from various sources. And that's what it is. So, yeah, you run a risk. So, do you ever do risky things? Any risky sports? Do you ski?
I used to. Not anymore, though.
Used to ski. So when you skied, did you worry about hitting a tree and dying from hitting the tree?
Not really, no.
No. But that was a risk. That was a risk, you know. And have you done any other risky things in your life?
Oh, yes. Driven too fast. I used to wrestle in college and in high school.
Yeah, So, you know, we run risks all the time.
Well,
so
as you point out, Zorba, just driving is a...
driving is a risk, yeah. But if you notice, he said driving too fast. So he increased the risk. So is there a risk? Yes. So for me, the idea is I happen to like it. I occasionally eat it, but I don't have it every Saturday night. And so I've reduced the risk by reducing the times that I eat it. And my kids are horrified, by the way. They go, how can you eat this raw hamburger? And I said, actually, with some onions. And the right slice of bread or on a cracker, it actually tastes pretty good. So that's my take on it. Enjoy.
Thanks for your time and trouble.
Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, time again to give one of our listeners a chance to air a grievance. Our producer, Carl, recorded a new theme song for this segment. So here we go, Zorba. Disagreeing with the doc.
Disagreeing with the doc. Disagreeing with the doc. Oh, oh, oh.
Heather.
You know, I love it. It's so gentle.
Oh,
it just sort of lulls you into that before you actually get the storm.
Well, they don't want to beat you over the head with it.
Right.
It's just
That's right, yeah.
Heather in Estes Park, Colorado, wrote the following on our Facebook page. Zorba. On a recent show, a caller asked about Splenda usage. I was very disturbed that you told her she could consume up to a cup a day. Just because it is approved by our FDA, it does not mean it is safe. Splenda is a synthetic compound accidentally discovered by scientists making pesticides.
I did not know that.
Artificial sweeteners basically...
Evil scientists making pesticides. I'm just picturing a sci-fi evil scientist. Why would they taste a pesticide and find out it's sweet? That's what I want to know. This is like somebody drinking the urine of a diabetic years ago and discovering that urine was sweet. So, hey, honey, I made a pesticide. Try this. It's sweet.
Artificial sweeteners basically trick your body into thinking that it's going to receive sugar.
Trick! Just like evil science.
That's
tricks
right.
Your body. It's really a pesticide.
But
please,
when the
go
sugar
on.
Doesn't come, your body continues to signal that it needs more, which results in carb cravings.
Well, that may be true. That
thus worsening insulin sensitivity and promoting weight gain.
Yes.
The best recommendation for anyone who has issues with sugar is to reduce or eliminate it from their diet. Otherwise, the only low-calorie sweetener that doesn't have any known negative side effects I have come across is stevia. I hope this is helpful.
Well, first of all, the
you never
evil,
said drink a cup of.
I just want to know once again, who would ever taste a pesticide? That's kind of.
But
it.
She says you recommend.
I never recommended a cup. No, I never. Yeah, I think I'm gonna have a cup of Splenda. That's a lot of Splenda.
Yeah.
In fact, if you're making iced tea with Splenda, that's about half a gallon, and you know, so maybe somebody can. But there's no evidence also that Truvia may do exactly the same as the Splenda. So I disagree completely with the Truvia as a brand of stevia. But stevia may also trick your body and say, hey, here's something sweet. It may increase sugar cravings later on. So the idea that you can eat stevia and it's going to be safe, I don't agree with. It is a natural product. There's no doubt about it. It's not manufactured, but there's no evidence that people who consume stevia lose weight, and that's the big issue. We thought that using non-caloric sweeteners would help people lose weight, and the answer is It doesn't matter which one it is. Saccharin, sucral, you probably don't remember what sucral was.
I do, yeah.
It was made by Abbott. Then it was found to kill people with cancer, maybe. Sucral, saccharin, by the way, is 120 years old, and it was never outlawed. Teddy Roosevelt wanted to outlaw saccharin, and he was pushed back by Congress with that. That was interesting. But all these non-caloric sweeteners, they may trick the body into wanting more carbohydrates. So I do not think that stevia is, it may be safer, it may not be safer, but it does not cause you to lose weight. But, as always, thank you so much.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said? Don't sugarcoat it. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook, even if you're a mad scientist.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. Coming up next, it's some interesting research to talk about. More of your calls, of course, and our medical MythBuster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we're still concerned, of course, about the Zika virus.
That's right. That's right. So Zika virus has been around actually for a long time. It was discovered, I think, back in 1947, something like that. But of course, there is an outbreak now, and its association with microcephaly and other neurological defects and other problems is a big public health problem, leading WHO to declare an emergency, leading to money being granted to try to actually get rid of the scourge of it. I mean, there's stuff we know about it and stuff we don't know about.
Yeah, the mosquitoes, of course, are.
Mosquitoes are the main vector for this. So getting rid of the mosquito that actually carries it, that mosquito is a common mosquito along places like Brazil, the Caribbean, Central America. So we know it's spread that way. We know the virus is present in fluids such as sperm. You know, so there's now been, if men have been to Brazil, for instance, and they may have contracted Zika, the issue is then using appropriate precautions so they don't get a woman pregnant. Because once again, it's in evolution. This is a virus that we don't understand very well at all.
And the main concern now is Brazil and
other places in the Caribbean. Yeah, the Caribbean, that are going to the Caribbean.
Well, now, as it gets warmer in the United States, is this going to be more
of a this particular mosquito, for instance, in Wisconsin, it's not the mosquito that we have. But the concern is how this virus is actually spread. Initially we thought it's not spread from person to person. Now the question comes up, because we see it in different fluids, we've seen it in saliva, whether or not it actually can be spread from person to person. And then is there another issue that's involved with microcephaly, with this terrible birth defect? And that microcephaly, a small brain, can lead to a full life of a child that becomes adult with a severe disability.
This, of course, is the major concern.
This is the major concern. If we look back at rubella as a good example, there was a public health issue that was very important back in the 40s and 50s. German measles was benign for regular people. If you got it as a child, it wasn't an issue. But if a pregnant mother got it, she had a child with many defects, loss in IQ, cataracts, hearing defects, lots of other things that went on. We developed a vaccine. There's almost universal vaccination of rubella in this country with pregnant women, and that's really the way to go. It's really vaccination.
Yeah. We've periodically gotten more information about this.
That's right.
Do you think
that's
we have all the information?
Right. No, we don't. We don't have all the information, and that's the issue. I think the bottom line information is, for a woman who may want to get pregnant, I think traveling to Brazil and other areas is something that I would give a lot of consideration, and I wouldn't do it if it were elective, at least until we know how this is going to play out. It's an important thing for any woman who wants to get pregnant to think about and take seriously.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phone, Zorba, a listener with us in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you both for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
My question is kind of a twofold. So I recently have started obeying my body full-time and switched to a gluten-free diet full-time. I was kind of dabbling in it, and that really doesn't do anything. And I don't have a gluten allergy, but I do have a gluten sensitivity, and it's made a huge difference. But also recently, I have been diagnosed as pre-diabetic. So I've been increasing my veggie intake, which was already pretty good, and I eat meat protein, but I'm only eating quinoa as a grain, and I find that I am starving all the time. Mm-hmm. So how do I maintain this calorie intake without upsetting my stomach and keeping a very low sugar intake as well?
Sure. Well, there are a few things. What was your blood sugar pre-diabetic? What was the number? Do you remember?
I want to say 120.
Okay, so 120. I mean, diabetes is roughly 126. I mean, we've got an arbitrary number that we look at for diabetes. We've got another test called the hemoglobin A1C. Did they do that test also?
Not yet.
So let's talk about a few things. So first of all, we know that there are a couple of things that you can do from traveling from pre-diabetic to diabetic. So we know that refined sugar is bad because all of a sudden your pancreas has to produce a lot of insulin. We know that simply a lot of food, a lot of calories, you know, that get metabolized into sugar is bad because all of a sudden your insulin has to come from your pancreas. So we know that whole grains of any sort and less refined carbohydrates are good for a diabetic diet. It does not have to be quinoa at all. It just has to be a whole grain. We know that
What's quinoa?
What is quinoa? Quinoa is a grain. I think of it as a grain, but is it a grain, caller? Do you know? I mean, it's a vegetable.
I think it's a seed, actually. I think that's what I've
heard.
Oh, I can more of a seed,
you know,
than a grain.
I can just imagine all the emails coming in saying, no, no, you called it a grain. But it's actually a seed.
Is this something that tastes good, or do you just use it?
Does quinoa taste good? Okay, here's the question.
Yes, it's very versatile.
Oh, it's very versatile. Okay, we are going to put on our website, zorbapastor.org, we are going to put on a question. People are going to answer yes or no. Is quinoa tasty? And we are going to do a follow-up thing. Is that agreeable, Carl?
That works for me.
That works. See, Carl is going to do that. I think it's debatable whether or not quinoa is tasty, but you can make some tasty things.
It's how you make it.
It's how you make it. It can taste like cardboard. Let me tell you, Tom, it can have no taste
well,
at all.
Let's not have a quinoa recipe.
Let's put it this way. It's not like sunflower seeds, which taste really good when you take it automatically. But we're going to do a quinoa vote. That's what we're going to do, a quinoa vote. So now let's get back to the actual question we're talking about, of pre-diabetes. How much do you exercise?
I walk every day.
How much?
Maybe total an hour.
An hour is good.
I walk with my dog.
An hour is good. That's critical because walking is a critical part of diabetes or exercise of any sort, not just walking. It is a totally separate variable. What's your weight?
It's pretty low. It's 118.
Okay, so weight is not an issue. You know, often weight is an issue. You have diabetes in your family?
No.
Because family history is an issue. So weight is not an issue. Exercise is not an issue. So the best advice that I would give is, you know, we know that having more food throughout the day when you're eating is better than having three larger meals. In other words, so old Dr. Kellogg, who I joined with years ago, and this is before a drug such as metformin were around, which is a drug that may prevent diabetes and is used in diabetes. Old Dr. Kellogg used to say, and he was old when I knew him, by the way. He was never a young Dr. Kellogg in my mind. He was in World War II and was in Korea, to give you an idea. He would always tell diabetics, eat five meals a day, make them small. And that wasn't bad advice. In other words, for the amount of calories that you're spreading throughout the day, if you kind of look at what your caloric intake is, which is going to be, we'll say, 1,600 calories a day, 1,400, 1,800 calories, have something in the morning, have a little something mid-morning, have something sort of noonish or that, a little something maybe late afternoon, and then have something to eat at dinner. For the most days, these are not days when you go out with friends, that would be different. So spreading those calories throughout the day reduces the sudden jolt of insulin that your body will have to produce in the pancreas. That's one advice. And the other advice, as I said, is staying away from things that are going to be metabolized quickly. And so if you look at the glycemic index of food, are you familiar with that?
I'm becoming familiar. It's kind of complicated.
Well, it's complicated, but it's also easy. Google glycemic index, you'll pop it out, you put in a food, it'll tell you what the glycemic index. So highest glycemic index is sugar. You know, so if you eat Karo corn syrup, if you swallow Karo corn syrup, Coca-Cola, that makes your body produce the most insulin. And if you eat quinoa, it probably has the lowest glycemic index of all. And that's what you're looking at. You're looking for low glycemic index foods on the whole. And
Okay.
It's not every day. Everyone has to have some ice cream. Everyone has to have a Coke if you want to have a Coke or orange juice. I mean, we all have to enjoy that every so often. It's what you do throughout most days that really count.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbusters segment. Today's question is from a listener, Tim, in River Falls, Wisconsin. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, we have two daughters, ages 46 and 48. Both complain about being cold. The older one has a body temperature of 96 degrees, and the younger one, 95 degrees. When they feel chilled, they both have temperatures in the 94 to 94.5 degree range. When I looked at the internet, it said any time your temperature is below 96 degrees, you should go to the emergency room. What are your thoughts? Is this just a myth?
I think the thoughts are stop looking at the internet. That would be my thought.
No truth to that.
Absolutely no truth at all. Not at all. Now, if you, let's say you're normally 98.6, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you know, you are faint, you're weak, you're pale, you've just, you know, you've had diarrhea, you're vomiting, and your temperature is 96. Yeah, get thee to emergency room. That's about it. But just temperature-wise, no. And why are you taking your temperature all the time? I mean, some people just run low and run high, and some people, frankly, are cold-blooded, as my mother yeah. used to say, and they just have to wear sweaters all the time.
Your temperature if you're yeah. chilled all the time.
Yeah, but otherwise, why take the temperature? A little bit obsessive.
But
anyway, they run low. And some people run low and they don't feel cold. And some people run low and they feel really cold. So I wear a sweater and stay home.
Have a myth for Zorba to tackle? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Eagle, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello from Eagle.
Yeah, how can we help?
Well, I'm having a problem at night. I'm having phlegm collecting in the back of my throat just at night. And if I, like, wake up and turn over, I'll take, like, three quick breaths, really kind of heavy, inhale.
Okay.
And the phlegm goes somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's going into the lung.
Not into the
or
lung.
Or if I'm
yeah,
ingesting.
Yeah, if it goes into your lung, you'd probably cough. I mean, the reason
oh, yeah,
we have phlegm comes from the lung, but doesn't usually go to the lung. Although when we cough and we're gurgling, it's kind of going back to the lung. So
we go to the stomach.
Yeah, you're swallowing
so you
your
think,
phlegm.
I'm ingesting it.
I think you're – wait,
so
but
I
it's you. Remember, you
break.
Are your phlegm. That's what we say. You are your phlegm. It's not a foreign substance. You made it.
More than
you're
her
swallowing.
Phlegm.
Well, she's more than her phlegm. You are more than your phlegm. But the phlegm is you. I mean, that's part. I mean, you produced it. You're swallowing it.
And I'm swallowing it.
Yeah, you're
and my family
uh-huh.
doctor, I just yeah. asked her to look at my throat, mm-hmm. and all she would say is, "Well, there's some stippling."
Stippling.
I
think
no
of stippling
idea
as
what
paint.
That means.
My father used to make a wall at home and he stippled it with paint. So stippling just means kind of polka dot. I guess you would think of it as polka dot. But she can't see into the down deep in the lungs. If you look in the back of the throat, if you want to see actually down there, you need to have a special scope to actually look in the back there and see it down. But let me go back a second. First of all, do you smoke?
No, never.
Do you have asthma?
No.
Okay, you don't have asthma. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I have a suggestion. I would moisturize the air in your bedroom. That's what I would do. I would get an ultrasonic humidifier, and I would moisturize the air. The problem is often the air can be too dry. Your mouth may be open in the middle of the night when you're sleeping.
I
would moisturize the air because your body may be producing mucus because the air is too dry. And
I never
so
thought of
what
that.
You want to do is do that. So an ultrasonic vaporizer does a lot. I recommend ultrasonics because they're more expensive, but the droplets are smaller, they are quieter, and they are better. You can use water from the sink, except if you see a scum on the vaporizer, which is calcium, then that means you're going to have to go to distilled water. And that's what I would do. I would use water from the vaporizer and see if that works.
I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for listening in Eagle. I appreciate it. Beautiful up there. It's a beautiful area.
It is. Kettle Marine area.
It's a beautiful area. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for your help today. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Appreciate the call. And before we head out today, Zorba, we recently received this email from Jan from West Lafayette, Indiana, who's responding to a recent caller who was asking about the efficacy of ear candles. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. A few years ago, a friend brought over some ear candles to try out and see how they might work to remove earwax and, of course, supposed toxins. We succeeded in not setting our heads on fire and and were grossed out gunky-looking waxy residue left inside each ear candle cone when we cut them open after use. Uh-huh. Then we burned one the same way, but over the sink and nowhere near anybody's ears. When we cut that one open, we found, drum roll, the very same gunky-looking stuff as before. Evidently, it was the wax residue from the cone itself."
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You got it. That's right. It does not pull wax out of the ear. It does not do that. However, it does. It may produce a little warmth in the ear and make you feel better. And that's, you know, and that's
okay,
totally fine. That's right. And we put that up on the web. We've got it somewhere where I think either I got candle or you got candle. I don't remember.
If it wasn't you,
it must have been me.
Maybe our producer, Carl, or our technical director, Brad.
It could have been one of us. I can't remember. Who knows?
Have a story to share? We're all ears. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0220Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.